Podcast, episode number 324. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have on the show for the very first time Greg Robbins of course, Crushing Performance, but also thestrengthhost.com. Greg, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably something that I should have done a long time ago, and I think it was, man, maybe almost 2 years ago that we bumped into each other at Crushing Performance, but you've been working there for, what is it, like 3 years now?
Just about 3 years, yep.
Wow. So for people that don't know, like Crushing Performance is now, actually it's really Cressy. You guys changed the name.
Yes. We're Cressy Sports Performance now.
And now you have multiple locations.
Yes, we do. Yep.
You and Tony are holding down the fort up in Hudson.
Yeah, and Eric took off to Florida, avoided the snow, and so it's been good. It's been nice to have a little bit more responsibility and you know, man the ship while he's away. It's been a good move, and I think it's freed up. I think it's just made our business better, actually. So it's been exciting.
Well, let's start there. And we did get some questions from people that just wanted to know what your path really was, and specifically from Dustin, who wanted to know, you know, how you got into the field and then how you found yourself at CSP.
Okay, yeah. I guess there's always like a long story and a short story, so I'll give you somewhere in the middle. But as far as fitness goes, I played high school baseball, and I was kind of a kid that just got by on talent. I didn't really have much experience in the weight room, any speed, any strength. So I got recruited to play at a Division III college, and I showed up freshman year and realized I probably wasn't going to play at all unless I got in better shape. So I kind of just went off basic stuff that you – well, actually, to backtrack, at my last year of high school – I went to Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning for a winter, and that was kind of my first little intro into working out. So when I got to college, I kind of just went off what I knew, what I had kind of learned as far as exercises go there, just use common sense. And, you know, the structure of college was good for me in that I had practice, we had to show up to eat meals, and we had to go to the gym when it was open between classes. So I just ended up with a nice little schedule and kind of took off with getting myself into shape and really fell in love with it. And that kind of just led to, I think, everyone's path in that way, that you just sort of start reading more stuff online, seeing what you can get your hands on. And even though through college I was always studying English, this was kind of my passion, something that I really enjoyed. And I started, you know, as I had success and people saw me change my body, I was helping friends, et cetera, et cetera. So when it came time to start working, I chose to just do the personal training route. And I did that for about 3 years in a commercial gym. And it was good at first, but I guess I'm sort of always have high standards. And when you kind of feel like you're not getting better anymore, it's time to move on. I didn't know exactly where to go next, but I knew I didn't want to be there. So I started taking a lot of my own clients just outside of the gym, running my own classes. It was the summer at that point, spring, summer. I knew that would eventually run out. I got an internship at Total Performance Sports in Everett, Massachusetts. And that was eye-opening, too, because it was just a different environment than I had been exposed to before, and it really was good for me. I had had experience now with more general fitness, athletics through my own baseball career, and this kind of exposed me to a little bit more maximal strength training, strongman training, that whole world. So I kind of added that to my skill set, and that's also kind of where I fell in love with more powerlifting for my own training. And it was while I was there that I ended up talking to Eric, and they had a spot open, and I applied and interviewed, and I guess the rest is history. I've been there for about 3 years now.
All right. So along with that, just to talk about stuff that's going on today. You're also putting together a seminar that's coming up called Optimizing the Big Three Workshop. Might as well start just talking a little bit about that, when that's coming up and where people can sign up for it if they want to check it out.
Yeah. So this is the second time that we're running this workshop. It's exciting. I loved it the first time we did it. We're going to do it on March 8th, so just about a month from today. As far as signing up goes, before I get into it, I mean, it is of note that there is an early price that ends on Sunday. So if you have a chance and you want to sign up for that, the best route to go is to head over to Eric's site, ericcressy.com, and then just put in the go over to the blog. And actually, there's a recent article right up at the top. That I wrote, and if you go to the bottom, there's a sign-up link. That's probably the easiest way to get to it, or the fastest way to get to it. But if you check my Facebook, even today, I'll shoot up a link right after we're done talking. But they'll be up all week long, so I'm sure you guys will be able to see them. But the workshop is exciting because we're talking about the big three, obviously: squat, bench press, and deadlift. But I'd like to think I attack it from somewhat of a different lens than, you know, maybe the normal workshop that you go to on those three lifts. I obviously have the experience in powerlifting, but I'm by no means, you know, a powerlifter by trade. It's not the only thing I do. So I work with a lot of athletes. I work with a lot of strength and conditioning coaches that work with athletes, and I work with a lot of general fitness people. So that's afforded me a lot of experience with figuring out how you help those people excel on exercises like a squat, a bench press, and a deadlift, and how you can fit them into different scenarios and different body types. Because not everyone is looking to become an elite powerlifter. They're just looking for a good basic training protocol that they can do with good technique and do well and excel at. And that's kind of the mindset behind the workshop.
We actually have a couple of our staff that are going to be heading over from MBSC to check it out too. So awesome. Definitely if you're in the area, go and check it out for the sign up. It is just a huge wealth of information, and you get to probably make fun of Tony Generalcore about the stupid movies he likes too. So
yeah, he'll definitely be there. Yeah.
Yeah. Do it. That's worth the price just right there. But let's talk about training and really start at the beginning and talk about warm-up and prep work. And we're going to be talking a lot about how you like to program. And we actually got a question from Mike Mullen, our good friend of the show and, of course, of PRI. And he's up in he probably has more snow up in Maine than we do here in Massachusetts. But he wanted to know. Or you wanted to pose the question, you know, what you do in terms of warm up and prep in terms of programming for that. Obviously, the number one answer is going to be it depends, but kind of if you could speak in generalities of what you like to do.
Yeah, sure. I feel like Michael's kind of checking in on me to make sure I'm warming up. I know Michael well too. He's come down a few times to help us out at CP. He's a wealth of knowledge. So I've learned a lot from him that I apply actually to our warm up and prep work. But in general, I would say, you know, it goes without saying, and you already mentioned it, that you do an assessment and you figure out where people are, what they need, and you give them what they need. But in general, if we're going to theme this a little bit towards maybe lifters, what we see a lot of is guys that are really stiff and really extended in their posture. So a lot of the things that I attack in a warm-up are just getting back to neutral, and that means to me just basically getting the tonic muscles on the backside of our body to just relax a little bit, getting the body as a whole to relax a little bit. So we'll use some positional breathing at the start of our warm-ups, and that's what I'll use in my warm-up too. Just one or two drills, nothing crazy. Not a big fan of spending 30 minutes warming up. I think that most of the warm-up can be done via taking some light sets on the actual exercises or doing some plyometric-type work. So one or two breathing exercises, the big rock ones, To, you know, two of the favorite ones that come to mind are just like a hemi bridge with your feet up on the wall in a 90-90 position, and a deep squat, sort of lat stretch with breathing. Those are two big ones that come to mind. From there, usually just going to work. I think of two things when I think of building a warm-up. The first is to just take a somewhat ground-to-standing approach, as well as a proximal-to-distal approach. So working on big proximal structures like repositioning the pelvis and repositioning the rib cage, and then working our way out to the extremities and doing things that maybe are more traditional, quote-unquote, like mobility exercises. And the second thing I think of is, if you're familiar with the people at Functional Movement, like the FMS and SFMA, they talk about the 4x4 matrix, where it's also kind of ground to standing. They go from prone and supine drills to quadruped all fours drills to more split stance, half kneeling or tall kneeling drills, and then some standing drills. So in general, I just kind of see where people are lacking and then build the warm-up from there. So it could be something like doing the breathing exercises just to get ourselves a little bit calmed down, a little bit relaxed, take down the overall tone of our body, and then do some core activation, glute activation type work, move from there into, again, more proximal stuff, maybe on all fours, like extension rotations for the thoracic spine, the upper back, and then you could do, that's a good spot to do like a bird dog, and then transition into something more half kneeling, like a hip flexor mobility, and then get up into more of a standing position and work on just basic, you know, lunges or lateral lunges, and then take that into some plyometric type work, easy stuff. If you're going to do, you know, some marches or skips, and then jumps or throws in some kind of variation, and then, you know, I'm a big fan with the people that I coach lifting wise that, you know, we take a lot of sets warming up to our working weight with just the bar, 95 pounds, 135 pounds, and we warm up that way as well.
And I know you guys deal, I mean, you're known for dealing with baseball players and working with athletes, but I know you're also spending a lot of time working with adults and getting a lot more adults through the door. So what are some of the things that you need to be more concerned about when it comes to the adults that are coming through opposed to like your overhead athletes?
Well, the adults have usually just put more mileage on their body. So, I mean, one thing I skipped entirely in talking about warming up and prep work was any kind of self myofascial release or, you know, foam rolling, that kind of stuff. I think that's something that goes a long way for adults. If you think about it, it's still fairly new of a concept. And someone in their, you know, mid-40s very well walk in there and never have any experience with something like that. So that can go a long way for them. So I think that's important, teaching them how to do that. Hitting home that, you know, you can do something like this for a little bit all the time, every day, it goes a long way. So that's a big difference. Whereas if I get a 16-year-old baseball player, obviously we talk about soft tissue work, we do it, but I don't think it goes as far for them as it does for the older populations. The other thing with adults too is they're just a little bit more cerebral in that you can probably get things like positional breathing home to them better. They understand fine details. If they have some sort of athletic background, they have more awareness of their body. So a lot of those drills that come from, you know, the good people at PRI and things like that, there's a lot of detail that goes into those, a lot of subtle movements. And so I think you can get those across to adult populations a little bit better, as opposed to some of the baseball players that, you know, you have to kind of meet them where they're at, and the younger kids meet them where they're at. So those are two big things that come to mind for the adult population. Other than that, I mean, I've seen adults walk in who move better than some 16-year-olds that walk in. So it's not always a case of saying that the adults need more of something or less of something. I guess it's just the mindset's a little bit different when I think about building a warm-up for them.
Well, maybe it's a good spot to go into working on speed and sprinting, because we did get some questions about that. So where do you like to program in your sprint work when it comes to training?
Most of the sprint work that I'm doing, programming it, is for the baseball population. I'd say, you know, we work with every sport, but we're definitely overwhelmingly populated by baseball players. So sprint work for baseball is going to be really focused on acceleration side of speed development. I can't really think of any time in baseball where a guy's going to reach absolute speed. So what I mean by that is, you know, the first 20 yards, we'll say you're, you know, 10 to 10 yards, really working on the first step speed, the acceleration. That's what baseball is really built around. Even if you're legging out a triple, you still have to turn, you still have to hit bases, you're not going to hit absolute speed. So our program design, when it comes to sprinting, is heavily based on teaching the basics and just getting the fundamentals of understanding what good running technique looks like. So we'll use a lot of just basic marches and skips. We'll use some sleds just to help teach positioning. We will do some, you know, open and closed loop drills, some reactive agility type drills as well. But I mean, I don't think it's fancy by any means. We're not hooking up bands to people and doing anything, you know, that looks super sexy, I guess, from the outside looking in. Really, I want our athletes to understand, you know, what a good shin angle is, what is a good position to get into, or what is the optimal position to get your body into, because in baseball, you're going to be starting laterally a lot of times, you're going to be stealing bases, you're going to be reacting to a ball. It's not going to be so cut and dry like in other sports, like, you know, a receiver in football or a track athlete would be the obvious example. It's going to be really learning, teaching your body what that optimal position is and understanding how to get into it from a lot of different places. So our progression is just based on starting very basic and then just adding a little bit more coordinated movements every month throughout the baseball off season.
And I know this is going to be one of those things that depends too, but for the adult population, are you programming any kind of like speed or sprinting stuff with them too?
I mean, it's in there. I think it's for some of them. For them, again, it's basically more just about getting them to move around. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to just think off the top of my head of some of the adult clients that I work with. I'll tend to go more on the side of using like med ball tosses. With them, I'll use like a prowler a lot for a lot of their marches and a lot of their quote unquote sprint work, just because it gets them in a great position. It takes down the stress of it a lot more. It depends, I guess. If someone walked in and that was something they wanted to work on, then we'd work on it. But it's not the first thing that comes to mind, you know, teaching them excellent sprint mechanics, just because, you know, you have to obviously prioritize things, and in the grand scheme of things, that's probably not number one. But if it was, I don't think I would change a ton from if a baseball player came in and really had no experience with sprinting. I'd probably attack them both the same way. We'd get down to I'm a big basics guy and just making those look awesome. So again, we'd start with basic march and skip variations and short 10 to 20 yard starts. We'd use tools like sleds or the wall, because those are pattern assists and they just help them get into optimal positions. And, you know, in a semi-private environment like we are at CSP, pattern assist things that force people to get in the right position are great, because they're your coach when there's no coach looking at you.
And we're going to take this second to take a very short break to, excuse me, for me to actually clear my throat, but we'll be back in a second with more from Greg. Stick around. Everyone, I just want to take a quick second to thank all of our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thefitcast. This week, I just want to say thank you to Paul Newton, Shannon Shriver, Maurice Anderson. We have some great people that are helping to make sure that this show keeps getting made. And if you've enjoyed the show in the past and you want to make sure that there is more episodes coming down the line, please take a second and go to that site. Again, it's patreon.com, patreon.com/thefitcast. And there you can start supporting the show at just $1 per episode. So literally about $4 per month can make sure that this show keeps getting made. So thank you everyone that is supporting the show. And if you've thought about it before, I really hope you take the time, you jump on there and you put a buck per episode towards the show to make sure that it can keep getting made. Let's get back to the show. All right, back for more from Greg. And now I want to really dive into programming. And, you know, that's one of the big things that you're going to be talking about, I know, at the seminar as well. But for a lot of our audience, we got questions just about, like, how you like to program. And let's give you some kind of, like, general road to go down. And that would be someone that is strictly looking to get stronger, and maybe it is that general population person that does have, you know, 3, maybe if you're lucky, 4 days a week of training. Let's just say 3 for just the hell of it.
Yep. All right. Yeah. So programming for, we'll just say, the maximal strength. We're looking, you know, the big things that I'm trying to do is, and anytime you're trying to get stronger, you have to do more than you could do before. And so doing more than you did before is really largely just a matter of you understanding all the different training variables and taking note of whether or not you're improving on them. So where most people go wrong trying to get stronger is they equate everything to one training variable, and that's intensity. So if there's not more weight on the bar, they don't understand whether or not they're getting stronger. And that's a grave mistake, because unless you're, you know, a really true beginner who's had the advice, obviously, to start submaximally enough that you could just add a little bit to the bar every week, it's not going to work in the long run. So the true beginner, it will work. You can start, you know, somewhere near 40 or 50% of what you're capable of and just start adding a little bit each week. But eventually that comes to a halt, and that's where most people end up, you know, in my hands or, you know, any of our hands, is that they're stuck. They want to get better, and they're not exactly sure the optimal way to do that. So that's when you just start to introduce them to other training variables. And I think the biggest one is volume, and that's the total amount of work that you're putting through, either in a single session, in a single week, in a single month, in a single training phase, you know, in a single year. To really look back and be able to say, you know, this is the peak that I reached. And in order to reach a higher peak, I'm going to need to build a bigger base. So, you know, I always will draw out a couple triangles for people and just show them, you know, this is your peak right now, and this is the size of the base that you created to reach that peak. And our goal is going to be to create a base this big, because a base this big at the bottom of your triangle can support a peak this much higher than the one that you're currently able to reach. So it's a question of monitoring more than just what you can do for one rep. It's understanding, you know, what can I do for 3 reps, 5 reps? What can I move total poundage wise on a squat in a single session right now? So we're just really just spanning out from where they want to be and breaking it way down like a Christmas tree effect into what it's going to take volume wise to ramp themselves back up. So that's probably number one, just looking at that training variable and understanding the importance of working more submaximally and putting a lot of volume into your training.
Maybe we can pause for a second and just take a look at some of the like almost not to go into like a default program that you would use or like what a day one would look like, but just in terms of like setting reps, like what are we talking about in terms of total volume for someone that is maybe just coming to you? And like you said, they need to build that bigger base.
Yeah. So, usually what we'll do it's got to be based on some sort of progression. And there's obviously a lot of different ways to organize your training. And, you know, the word periodization always pops up. There's a lot of periodization schemes that work, and they're all built off that same thing. But I'll look at total reps in a session, and I'll say, you know, today we're going to do on the squat, we're going to do, let's say, you know, 40 total reps. And in order to get 40 total reps, we're going to have to work at a lower percentage, like 60 to 65% of your one rep max. So you might be looking at things like, you know, 8 sets of 5 at 60% just across the board. And that's a ton more volume than people are used to doing. And the weight on the bar seems light. And for the people that don't have experience with it, it seems counterproductive. But, you know, if you work your way from 40 total reps, you know, back to one total rep over the course of, you know, 16, 20 weeks, and you're going from 60% intensity all the way up to, you know, 100% intensity, then, you know, good things are going to happen, especially if you start to understand, you know, some of the other variables that we can talk about as well. But to give you an idea, on the main lift, like a squat or a bench press or even a deadlift, you're going to be putting in, you know, set numbers that are way higher than what people are used to. I think everyone's kind of used to, like, you know, 3 or 4 sets, and I'll sometimes cut the weight in half that they're doing and double that. If there's someone that needs to work on their technique, we could do 10, 12 sets with just 3 reps, just to make sure that the technique is perfect every single time. And then from there, the other way that you build volume is you choose what we'll call supplementary lifts. So supplementary lifts are something that's a very close variation to that exercise that can do a couple things for you. And the number one thing it can do for you is just teach you about that lift. So we'll use the squat as an example. You know, a pause squat could be a supplementary lift where you pause for a few seconds in the bottom of the squat, or a squat from the pins, like an Anderson squat, is another one where you get the chance to lower the bar down to the pins, understand where you are in the hole, adjust if you need to, and then drive back up. You could use high bar squats. You could use squats versus chains, squats against band, squats with reverse bands, all kinds of different things depending on, you know, where you've located someone's technique flaws first and foremost, and then possibly just weaknesses in or sticking points in the lift to bring them up. So the good thing about working submaximally with your intensity is that you leave room to do more of these supplementary lifts. So you can squat and you can do, you know, 6 sets of 5 and put in 30 total reps there. And then you could, you know, go down to a pause squat and do another like 5 sets of 2 on the pause squat and get another 10 total reps to make, you know, 40 if that was your goal. And then what happens is over the course of the training cycle, you start to condense all these different variations that you're using. So you start with this huge base of not only volume, but also different exercise variations, and then you just start taking things away slowly. As the intensity comes back up on the bar, you start taking away these variations, and the idea is that, you know, your technique has improved, you've spent more time building up a base and a work capacity for lifting, and when you get to these heavier sets in the 80 to 95% range, you know, all of a sudden they're going to be a lot easier and you're eventually going to be able to up the intensity and put more weight on the bar.
So in terms of like a again, we'll kind of like use it the term of a template on a day one, what would a normal day one look like in total for, again, well, maybe we'll just stick this into like an adult that is looking to get started. I know we definitely have some coaches that listen to this show, but I know most of the people tuning in are going to be more your general population, the weekend warriors that are just looking to get stronger.
Yeah. So a general, let's just say it's month one, mm-hmm. and we're looking to improve your squat. The first thing I would do is objectively look at your squat right now. When it gets heavy, you know, where did things go wrong? Let's say, for example, in the back squat, you tend to tip forward a lot. Or actually, we'll use this as an example because it's easier. We'll say that when it gets heavy, your knees tend to buckle in a lot. Your weight drops forward. Now you have a hard time controlling that. So an easy thing that you could do to work on that is to say that, you know, for this training block, number one, because the weights are going to be lighter, I can use almost a more difficult variation to put most of my work in. So I'm going to make the exercise harder, not by putting weight on the bar, but by possibly, you know, putting a mini band around my thighs and doing some of my squats with a pause at parallel so that I can understand what it feels like to drive my knees out, keep my torso tall when I come out of the hole. So if we're looking at the amount of work you're going to put in, you want to do two things. You still want to squat the way that you're, you know, we call it like a competition exercise. But we'll just say we're still going to squat the normal way because that's what you want to eventually improve. So you have to always keep an element of that in your program. So you could start the day off by taking the normal squat, you know, for 3-4 sets at a lighter weight, work on your technique. Also get your body kind of primed up. All right, you're at, let's say, still 60, 65% of what you're capable of. And now, once we do that, we're going to make the exercise harder, not by putting weight on the bar, but by changing the variation slightly. So that's when maybe we'll throw the mini band around the lower thigh, and we'll add a 1 or 2 second pause at parallel. And now we'll get another 3 or 4 sets done like that. And over the course of the training block, over the course of 4 weeks, we'll say, every week you'll bring the total amount of reps down over what you're doing on the squat and the pause squat. So if you started at 40 in week one, you could say, okay, we're going to go down to, you know, 35 or 30 total reps in week two. And the weight's going to go up a little bit to 65, 70%. And then we're going to take the total amount of reps down a little bit in week three to 30, 25 reps. And we're going to bring the weight up again to 70, 75%. And you can sort of continue like that. I mean, that's one easy way to look at it, but it will definitely have a lot of production for most people.
Yeah, no, maybe this is a good place to put this one in too, but like, what do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that people are making? Like, what do you see when people are coming to you for help and be like, yeah, this is another person that has been doing this for the last year and they, you know, obviously they're not getting results?
I mean, the number one thing that I usually see with people that's going to make the biggest impact on their numbers and their strength is just their technique. So mm-hmm. a lot of people are already stronger than they are able to display. And what they do, they're just lacking the correct position to display the strength that they have. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, we're going to look at how we can improve technique. And that, again, goes back to why it's so important to use some submaximal training, because you're just not going to be able to work on that technique if you're constantly going up to, you know, if you're constant, there's that old adage of if you're constantly testing your strength instead of building your strength, then you're not going to get anywhere. And that's what most people are doing. They're testing their strength all the time, and they're not building it. They're not stepping back and objectively looking at what needs to improve from a technique standpoint and then putting in all that volume working on it.
Gotcha. We'll mix this up a little bit. We did get some questions just in terms for females and progressing to doing bodyweight chin-ups. Any pro tips on stuff like that?
For chin-ups, I think, you know, my approach is again, not a fancy one using some sort of scheme necessarily. It's more about specificity. So mm-hmm. Specificity is king. If you really want to improve on something, then you should just do the thing more often. You know, so if someone's working on trying to get to their first bodyweight chin-up, then there's really no reason why they shouldn't just do chin-ups, you know, 6 out of 7 days a week. And just spread out a ton of volume over those days. as far as the variations, obviously you can't say, we'll just do chin-ups because they can't do them yet. So you're going to have to figure out something that they can do. So usually we'll see first kind of just assess, well, what can you do? Can you do them band assisted? Can you jump up to the bar and hold the top and work on the eccentric portion of it? Those are the things that don't involve any assistance are going to be the closest transfer. So jumping up and being able to hold yourself at the top for a max hold is going to be better, I think, than band assisted. Doing eccentrics with the hold, if you can really control it for a good 5-10 seconds on the way down, is going to be better than the max hold at the top. If you're still pretty far away from a chin-up, even a band assist isn't really too feasible for you, then you just need to put in a lot more time doing more, I guess, rowing exercises, really. Closed chain rowing exercises would probably have the most transfer, like inverted rows with TRX straps or on a barbell. It doesn't hurt to do more vertical pulling, open chain too, like lat pull downs or dumbbell rows, things like that. I would also say, one thing, and it's sometimes a tough conversation, is sometimes people just can't do bodyweight chin-ups because it's going to take them a really long time because the actual weight that they're trying to pull up over the bar is just not feasible for a while. So, there's not too many people that are super light that can't pull themselves up over the bar. So there's always that combination too when you're talking about the general fitness crowd of working on the strength while also improving body composition, because if you're carrying around a lot of extra pounds, then it's just going to take a while to be able to do a chin-up and actually pull 160 pounds up over the bar.
And this is going to be a tough one to handle on audio, but we also got questions in regards to kettlebell training tips, or, this is one of the most visual things that, in terms of the things that we do in the gym, but anything that you could give to people audibly.
Kettlebell tips. I think the kettlebell is a great tool. There's some people that exclusively use the kettlebell. That's definitely not me or what we do at CSP by any means.
Remember Eric was so against getting kettlebells when I was training there. And eventually, I think it was Danny Verna, bought like a couple kettlebells for the gym. And then finally we started doing like get ups and stuff like that. And slowly it started getting into like just the supplementary work of the program.
Yeah. Well, the kettlebell is a phenomenal tool and there's a lot of great things you can do with it. But to me, and I could stand corrected if, someone wanted to correct me, but, if you don't have kettlebells and you want to work on your overhead press, you could still use a dumbbell. If you want to do Turkish get-ups, you could still use a dumbbell. Mm-hmm. But the kettlebell does afford you some things, and I think, some of the ways that I'll use them most often is obviously swings. Swings are a great exercise to work on. They're a great exercise for a few reasons. One, they work on that explosive hip extension. So I use them in my own deadlift training. I use them with athletes a lot in their pre-work. And they are obviously a great conditioning tool too because they have a high metabolic demand. And then the last thing about a kettlebell swing that is really great in my eyes is the lack of any kind of eccentric stress with them. You're basically, if you're doing it correctly, just letting that kettlebell fall in control, and it's really just a concentric-based exercise. So it's a great one in season for athletes to minimize soreness and another way to add additional volume to their program because of the lack of an eccentric load. And then the other way is the fact that you can hold a kettlebell upside down, which gives you this whole element of having to work on grip strength and shoulder stability, which obviously comes in huge with our population in baseball. It can be used advantageously by a lot of people too to work on those things, both grip strength and shoulder stability, in a way that you're probably not going to be able to get with a traditional dumbbell.
Let's hit on deadlifting, just since you brought it up. We also got questions from people asking for any deadlifting tips, and really pretty much anything Greg wants to talk about will be awesome. So I guess I don't have the name that this is attributed to, but yeah, deadlifting tips.
In general,
I know it's a super broad question, but I mean, I was like, all right, well, we'll see where it goes.
All right. Deadlifting tips. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, the common mistakes, I guess, you know, some things that I've been just, when I run a lot of, distance based training with people who mm-hmm. want to improve the big three. And so that involves a lot of just watching videos and giving them feedback. And so some common themes, stuff that I find myself, you know, writing down on little comment boxes on Facebook all the time is just understanding where your leverages are. And I think people, you know, they watch or they hear someone say, well, this is how you do a conventional deadlift. You know, this is where your knees are supposed to be relative to your ankles and your shoulders relative, you know, to the bar, et cetera, et cetera. And what you really have to understand, again, is how you're built and what your leverages are going to be. So the biggest thing I always tell people on a deadlift is you have to understand the bar ideally needs to stay over your midfoot throughout that exercise, and it's being linked to your body via your scap, really, not so much your hands. So the important thing is, how can you position your body in the setup to get you in a position where the bar starts over your midfoot, the spine of your shoulder blade, or I like to just reference the armpit. Like, your armpit is either right over the bar, or in your head you're thinking about bringing the armpit slightly behind the bar, and that's gonna have a different position for everyone. So if you look at someone like myself, I have pretty proportionate leverages all around. My legs aren't really much longer, too long. My torso is pretty normal. My arms are pretty normal. So it equates to me being in a position where my shins start more angled. They're not vertical, like a lot of people say in my setup. They don't come to vertical until I've pulled the bar about an inch off the ground. If you look at someone like Eric, for example, Cressy, who's a great deadlifter, he also has longer arms than I think people realize. And so having longer arms is advantageous in the deadlift, because he can start his shins more vertical and still be able to get his armpit back over the bar. If I was to do that, my armpit would be over the bar at the start. When I pull, I'm more likely to come forward and really have my weight out in front. So again, if you want to be good at lifting, you have to kind of take a critical eye and say, all right, let me take a video of myself deadlifting. Let's pause. All right, here in the setup, where is the bar relative to my feet? Where are my armpits relative to the bar? How can I tweak my position to make that happen? So that's something I'm always talking with people about is, you know, don't necessarily try to fit yourself into one optimal deadlift positioning. Figure out what's optimal for you. And if you're having trouble figuring out what that is, try to find some videos of people that are built similarly to you that have success and mimic their position. So if you go and look at some of the best deadlifters in the world, you're going to see 6 or 7 different setups in the deadlift. And that's because, you know, they've optimized their leverages.
Just to stick on deadlifting for a second, is there any kind of like system that you like to use to rotate between the different types of deadlifts?
Probably the same system that I was sort of explaining with the squat. So we're going to always have some element of the actual deadlift in the program. But if we're working more submaximally, then we're going to want to try to choose some variations that will help someone optimize their technique. Mm-hmm. And so some of the variations that I use are actually kind of shunned upon, I feel like, by a lot of people as dangerous. But I think they're only dangerous if, you know, like any exercise, if you do them incorrectly. I'll use pause deadlifts quite a bit with people when they're first learning. And a pause deadlift is basically breaking the bar off the ground about an inch and holding it there for a second or two before coming all the way up. And as far as understanding if your setup is optimal, you know, that'll tell you right away. If you pull the bar an inch off the ground and hold it and you have all your weight forward, then you know that you're not setting yourself up in a way that you're able to pull back on the bar, keep the weight on your heels, and keep the weight in your hips through that initial pull. You know, another one is just, I'll use RDLs a lot just to help people build up upper back strength and again, groove a nice position. You know, if they're, I use a deficit deadlift a lot, which is another one that people, you know, kind of bat an eye at and say is dangerous. But if you do it correctly, a deficit deadlift can do a lot for teaching you about how to push off the floor and get proper power from the floor, because you're starting with more range of motion. So again, it's about looking at someone's technique and then thinking in your head, all right, this is their technique, this is where it goes wrong, what's a variation that I can give them that will coach them for me?
Mm-hmm. Cool. We did get another couple questions just in terms of what you do for scheduling and prep work for the weeks of training. And I guess this also fell on the side of, you know, nutrition and food prep as well.
I'm a big, you know, systematic, regimented type person when it comes to that stuff. And, you know, some people don't like the idea of being regimented or being disciplined, but in my eyes, the more disciplined you are, the more free you actually are, the more free you are to adjust on the fly, the more free you are to think about other things. So when it comes to prep, meal prep, it to me, it really just comes down to having some sort of system. Like, yeah, every day I walk in the door when I come back from the gym, and in the first, literally the first 30 minutes that I'm in the house, I just prep my meals for the next day. I just get it over with. So you got to find some easy ways that you can prepare like your core meals for the next day. You know, my go-tos are using things that allow you to do multiple things at once. So the oven comes to mind, the ancient oven. Putting chicken in the oven means that it's in there baking for 20 minutes and you can prepare the rest of your stuff so that it's all done at once. That's, you know, easier sometimes than having to do one part of your meal and then another. Kitchen gadgets. I like kitchen gadgets a lot. So I have like a rice cooker that also has a tray that goes on top that steams vegetables while it steams the rice. So
what kind of rice cooker you got? You got like one of those Zojirushis, like the Japanese ones?
I think it's just called Aroma, but it's definitely pretty industrial. I mean, it can cook a lot of rice. So, I mean, if I ever wanted to open like a small sushi restaurant, I think I'd be all set.
Yeah, man, those things are like going to Japanese restaurants and like seeing these gigantic, like, I don't know what I can say is like the size of, but it's almost like sticking your arms out and trying to make a circle like this size of a rice cooker that cooks rice perfectly and not the horrible way our American ass minute rice, you know, setup is. But yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's an awesome investment. I always tell everyone to grab a rice cooker.
So carbs are okay. We're just saying that right now for.
Oh, I think carbs. Yeah, I think carbs are more than okay. I'm definitely not a low carb advocate. Well, I mean, again, it depends. You know, if you're a really sedentary person that sits around all day sedentary, mm-hmm. Then you obviously are not expending as much energy and training as hard, then I don't think you need as many carbohydrates. But if you're someone that hits the gym four or five times a week, mm-hmm. and your goal is, you know, power and strength, carbohydrates, that's the energy system that you're running off of. So I'm way more into an adequate protein, higher carb, you know, medium fat-based diet. So
you've been talking a little bit about that. I know you had a guest post on Eric's site earlier in the week as well about that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm by no means a nutrition expert, but in my experience with my own nutrition, and also, you know, I have, you know, done nutrition plans for people that have been very successful in physique and fitness competitions too. I think that carbohydrates get a bad rap, but really what it comes down to from a body composition standpoint in my mind is understanding first and foremost calories in, calories out. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone wants to find a way around that, but I could stand corrected, but I don't think you can find a way around that, you know, too much. You're going to have to, it's going to have to be pretty much in line, and the more extraordinary you want your physique to be, the more in line that's going to have to be. And from there, then it's just about understanding macros to a degree. You need adequate protein, but I think people get way out of hand with as far as how much protein is enough. You know, I think at the very most, a gram of protein per body weight is enough. I think you could even fall a little bit under that and still be okay. And then, you know, I get a lot of my calories from carbohydrate sources, and it works just fine.
Just make sure that, you know, you're not picking up a bag of Skittles on the way to the gym. Like,
well,
there's
right.
obviously varying degrees of the nutrient density of the carbohydrate source.
Right. Yeah. I mean, nutrient density is another important thing too, and you got to make sure that your bases are covered there. I would say too, though, and I'm not advocating Skittles by any means, but I guess because I do end up working with a lot of people that want to get stronger, and I also work with a lot of skinny youth athletes, mm-hmm. I get to program or talk nutrition with a lot of people that want to gain weight, which is, you know, a little bit more fun sometimes than the people that want to lose weight. So and when you want to gain weight, or even if you just want to maintain a weight and you have a high level of activity, it's tough to get all those calories in from hugely nutrient-dense sources. So, you know, I think sometimes we do a disservice to people by always saying, well, it's got to be rice, sweet potatoes, and oats. Like, well, you know, good luck. It's going to be a lot tougher, A, to get a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old to just eat those things. And, you know, I know in my experience, when I'm trying to eat, you know, some days upwards towards 4,000 calories in a day, that's a lot of rice. That's a lot of sweet potatoes. It's a lot of oats. So it's not out of the realm of possibility for me that there's going to be, you know, like a bowl of rice Chex in there or something like that, that it's just a little bit easier to get down.
Yeah, I still remember the days where Pete over at CSP was going through like a continuous bulking phase. And there's also going to be some people out there that it's just harder for them to get that food down. They don't have that, you know, that always feeling hungry, always looking forward to the next meal that maybe some of our more overweight population might have.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, nutrition was something I think a few years ago I was way more into helping people with than I am now. And I think I just got discouraged with it because I just don't like a lot of times the way that we as an industry kind of approach nutrition, mm-hmm. In that we're just always trying to fill people's heads with more and more nutritional information. And that's really not their limiting factor a lot of times. I mean, I think that we could go, you know, if we're talking about, you know, people that already go to the gym and already kind of make themselves aware of a healthy lifestyle, people know what a healthy diet is. They know what it is well enough that they could be a lot more successful than they are. The limiting factor a lot of times is a matter of the mental side of things and having the discipline and stuff like that. So
totally.
I end up just coaching people a lot more on those ends and just trying to understand, you know, what's keeping you from prepping these meals? what makes you want to sit down at the end of the day, watch TV and you know, crush a pint of ice cream? Like, you know, I know we both know that that's not what you should be doing, but telling you again that that's not what you should be doing is not fixing the problem by any means.
Exactly. Well, you know, again, before we wrap up, of course, the workshop is coming up in a couple weeks, optimizing the big three. And again, that's going to be at your facility in Hudson, Mass, correct?
Yes. Yep.
So you get a nice little scenic drive into like Western Massachusetts a little bit, but it's well worth the trip. You get to check out the amazing facility that you guys have there. And yeah, it's just like a really great setup that you guys have. And definitely make sure if you are available and you have that day in your calendar open, go take a look. You can I'll put a link for it in the show notes as well. But like Greg was saying, you can also go to ericcressy.com and you can go through the blog post to look on there. You can try to jump on Greg's Facebook, which I should probably have the link for that in front of me right now. I don't, but you can also catch Greg on Twitter at Coach Greg Robbins. And I'll put all that stuff in the show notes in case you're driving and stuff like that. But I think other than that, man, I think this is a really good start. I think what we should do is maybe we'll take this as like a starting off point. We'll see if we get some more questions from the audience. And if you're willing, get you back on the show to do a follow-up.
Yeah, man, I'd love to. It was a great time talking about everything, and love to answer, you know, more questions. We hit like a lot of general topics, so if people have more specific questions coming off of those, then give more specific answers. That'd be awesome.
Absolutely, and again, it's thestrengthhouse.com, and like I said, I'll post all that stuff in the show notes on thefitcast.com. But thank you so much for checking out the show and for hopefully subscribing on iTunes. If you like it, I would also love if you reviewed the show on iTunes as well. You can follow the Fitcast at Fitcast on Twitter. And I'm at Kevin Larrabee. And until next week, thank you so much for tuning in. And Greg, thanks for taking time out of your Friday to join and hang out and talk about some strength and conditioning.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for listening, everybody. We'll